Hear now these words from the prophet Isaiah from the 6th chapter. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lofty, and the hem of the Lord's robe filled the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above. Each had 6 wings. With each they covered their faces, and with 2 they covered their feet, and with 2 they flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of God's glory." The pivots on the threshold shook at the voices of those who called, and the house filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me. I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding a live coal that had been taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. The seraph touched my mouth with it and said, "Now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed and your sin is blotted out." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I. Send me." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Please pray with me. Speak, O God, for your servants are listening. Amen. Worship is the main act of the Christian community of faith, it says on our website. Every Sunday, we gather to encounter God. We bring our voices, our music, the preacher's interpretive reflection on a Bible passage, our prayers of thanksgiving, our prayers of request, our hopes, our dreams, our pain, and sometimes even our protest. But we always join together with the expectation that God will meet us in worship. This kind of encounter with the holy is transformative. Well, after reading Isaiah, I think that description is way out of whack, and I'm pretty sure I'm the person who wrote it. Isaiah would put it like this: worship is the place where God turns our world upside down. God terrifies us with otherworldly displays of petrifying power, giving us no choice but to submit to God's assignment. In worship, God's voice speaks through God's music and God's story to demand allegiance to God with specific political and personal assignments for those whom God calls. Worship is God's domain, and no one escapes unscathed. Now, I expect a lot of you to take issue with the word terrifies, since we spend a lot of time here deprogramming people who have been trained to be afraid of God. It's not the word that I would choose either. I prefer to offset our fear of God with those Old Testament texts where God is described as a nursing mother, or God professes God's love for Israel, or where Leviticus calls on us all to love our neighbor as ourselves long before Jesus spoke these words. I was all prepared on this Trinity Sunday to preach a sermon about the relational nature of God. God's intrapersonal nature, which carries over into our interpersonal living. Terrifying is not my preferred descriptor for God. But terrifying is the only word that comes to mind after studying this passage. Isaiah has a vision of God in the temple with seraphs, S-E-R-A-P-H-S, in attendance. I've always thought as seraphs as your typical Baroque-style angel. you know, attractive looking, physically fit young adult, basically like a shirtless Chadwick Boseman with wings. Until one of the scholars recently pointed out that seraph in every other place in the Old Testament is a fiery serpent, including two other places in the book of Isaiah where it's translated as such. Our Bibles leave this word untranslated, which is cheating, since these scholars surely know that most of us are going to be thinking Chadwick Boseman with wings, not flying, flaming serpents. One of those fiery winged serpents brings a live coal and touches Isaiah's trembling lips. Now, I don't know about you, but if a winged fiery serpent brought a hot coal close to my lips while God sat watching from a throne in a temple, I'm done. Terrifying is an understatement. Truthfully, I feel a bit whiplashed, even tricked by our lectionary, that prescribed list of readings that we've been following over the last several months. All through Easter, we got all these texts about God's love for us. And just when we started thinking about this comforting God who is always there for us, the Spirit descends with a rushing wind and flaming tongues on Pentecost, knocking us off our balance. And then this week, flaming winged serpents teach us what real terrifying worship looks like. But maybe we need this kind of a tilt-a-whirl text to correct not only our sanitized, preferred definitions of seraphs, but also our preferred definitions of what a call from God actually looks like. Too many of us have been shaped by the idea that a call from God generates a feeling roughly equivalent to winning the lottery, or relaxing on the beach, or feeling at one with nature in the woods. I'm sure that some calls do come with that kind of a feeling. But Isaiah offers a different model. Isaiah's call comes with fear. As I see it, there are at least two kinds of fear in this text. Fear of God, and fear of the assignment. I'm not sure which kind is worse. Isaiah is called to go tell the people that hard times are ahead. This was not a popular announcement in the year that King Uzziah died, since Uzziah and his son helped Judah avoid an all-out conflict with the superpower to the north, Assyria. And so right about the time that Isaiah was receiving his call, Judah was feeling very much in the clear. Judah had been forced into a choice between an alliance with its cousin to the north, Israel, and another small nation of Syria, or an alliance with the superpower, Assyria. Uzziah had deftly avoided choosing either. Peace had been at hand for about 50 years. But Uzziah had wrongly assumed that his military might could compensate for his lack of faithfulness to God. So enter Isaiah, whose mission is to go tell the people that the worst is yet to come. That the people have so departed from God's ways that things have to get worse before they get better. Things have to be dismantled before they can be rebuilt. Not exactly a warm and fuzzy assignment. Maybe God's call is sometimes like that. Brian Stevenson said as much at the Johns Hopkins University commencement address this past Wednesday. He told the graduating class that they should see their degrees as a kind of authorization to participate in changing the world. Of the four things he told them they must do if they wanted to change the world, at least two of the four were not going to bring anyone warm feelings. You have to get proximate to pain, he told the graduates, and you have to do things that are inconvenient and uncomfortable. Neither of these things make life easier, but both of these things, he said, are necessary to change the world. Of course, Stevenson's words only make sense to people who want to change the world. And David Brooks wrote recently that such people are that way because someone planted an ideal in them early in their lives. Summarizing the book Some Do Care, Brooks wrote, "They are not tempted by worldly success because they are not interested in worldly success. They don't talk much about personal happiness because they're not particularly interested in themselves, period. Their identity is not based on being a lawyer or a pianist. Their identity is defined by a certain moral action. They feel at home in the world when they are performing that moral action and feel out of sorts when they are not." Maybe that's a call. Because while I don't know anyone who's ever seen flaming serpents with wings, I have encountered many who are listening for God's leading in their own lives, calling you, not to run from pain, calling you to do things inconvenient or uncomfortable. Maybe that's call, knowing that your roots lie in soil deeper than what passes for power in our transitory world, trusting that the choices that tug on your heart come from a place so far beyond you and your control that it can be frightening. It's like of the two fears present in Isaiah, the fear of the assignment and the fear of God's power, the fear of the assignment isn't even considered. And maybe terrifying isn't the right word for this passage. Maybe it's more like awe. Awe at a deeper power that comes from the Lord. Bryan Stevenson closed his remarks on Wednesday with a story about a man he met on one of his many speaking engagements. This older black man, Stevenson said, had a stern, angry look all through Stevenson's presentation at the church where he was speaking, somewhere in the South. And after everyone else had greeted him and gone home, this older black man, seated in a wheelchair, wheeled himself to the front of the church and got up in front of him and asked him, "Do you know what you're doing?" And Stevenson said he just stood there. So he asked him again, "Do you know what you're doing?" And Stevenson mumbled something. And so he asked him a third time, "Do you know what you're doing?" And this older man looked at him and said, "I'm going to tell you what you're doing. You're beating the drum for justice. You keep beating that drum for justice." And then this man grabbed him by his jacket and pulled him into his wheelchair and said, "Come here, I want to show you something." He said, "You see this scar I have behind my right ear? I got that scar in Greene County, Alabama in 1963 trying to register people to vote." And then he turned his head and he said, "You see this cut down here at the bottom of my neck? I got that cut in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1964 trying to register people to vote." And he turned his head again and he said, "You see this dark spot? That's my bruise. I got that bruise in Birmingham, Alabama in 1965 trying to register people to vote." And the man looked at Bryan Stevenson and said, "I'm going to tell you something, young man. People look at me and they think I'm some old man sitting in a wheelchair covered with cuts and bruises and scars. But," he said, "I'm going to tell you something. These are not my cuts. These are not my bruises. These are not my scars. These are my medals of honor. Sounds to me like a person called by God. Sounds to me like a person so in awe of God's power that there is little room for much fear of any assignment. Sounds to me like a person who, though she may fear many things, fears mostly not listening to that voice, tugging at her to get proximate to people's pain, compelling her to do what's inconvenient and uncomfortable, defining her identity not by worldly success, not by being a lawyer or a pianist, but by doing God's will in the world.